Hello, I'm Bianca.
And I'm Paloma, and you are listening to The Climate Press.
A podcast where we aim to bring together climate science with public understanding and action.
Today on the show, we have Astrid Kaus from the Center for Decision Research at the University of Leeds.
We'll be continuing on from last episode, and Astrid will be sharing insights into some of the challenges about communicating climate risks and how we as people understand those risks.
We will also discuss the role of the scientific community on supporting public action on climate change.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on the show.
So, Astrid, can you please tell us a little bit about your research and what you do here at the University of Leeds?
Yeah, sure. So, I'm a postdoctoral researcher and I study the science of science communication, roughly said. So, I have a background in psychology and I'm interested in how people understand complex phenomena such as climate change and how they relate to it in their daily lives and how we can make it more accessible to individuals who are non-climate experts and who have to make a lot of decisions that nonetheless regard to climate change. For example, insulating their houses or protecting themselves against floods or build new infrastructure like roads or define which plains are floodplains or something like that, or protect themselves against heat waves, people in the health sector and so on. So there's a broad range of individuals we have studied so far and how they relate to climate change.
Great. And can you tell us what is so challenging about making risks of climate change relatable and meaningful to people?
I will try from a psychological point of view. So climate change is a phenomenon that I would say we haven't faced before because it's so impacting our overall system. So our economic system, social and also politically, it has a lot of impact on how we decide and where we go. So this is one aspect. So it's a rather complex phenomenon compared to other types of risks that we face and that we have to make decisions about, like, for example, nuclear risks. These characteristics of climate change are quite obvious. So it's a change over long time periods, and it's not so clear which types of events around us, in particular when it comes to extreme weather, we can attribute to climate change and which ones not, and how that changes over a long time period. And I think this makes climate change more abstract than other types of risks, for example, health risks that we change. And another one is that the communication about climate change is not super straightforward. So there is a lot of empirical research, for example, on health communication and how we understand health risks. And I would say this is much easier to understand compared to a phenomenon like climate change, because usually, in a medical study, you have a treatment group and a control group, and then you have an effect in the treatment group that you can translate into a certain number of people, mm-hmm. and same in the control group. And then you can compare. That's like a simplified view onto medical information, but still. Mm-hmm. And this becomes more tricky with climate because how can you say how many people will be affected by something far in the future? So The communication about climate change builds on a basic statistic understanding that we need. And I have to say, this is not something that our schools or, that is really taught in schools. So our knowledge of statistics, such as the stats that are used by climate experts, is in fact pretty low. So in other words, I say we, so I mean general audiences or non-climate experts, we may sometimes not be risk literate enough to understand what, for example, specific probabilities mean. And I don't want to even mention or talk or go into the uncertainties related to climate change, for example, caused by the change over long time periods, and what those probabilities and the uncertainties actually mean for our daily life. So we have something to learn, I would say, to improve our daily decisions and also the political decisions we make now.
So as we talk about ways of making climate change more relatable and meaningful, Astrid, what is your advice to fellow scientists trying to engage with the public and effectively communicate this information?
Based on research that we have conducted here at the University of Leeds, and so we studied how decision makers across the UK understand climate and climate predictions about extreme weather, such as floods. And based on what they told us, on how they perceive it and what is important for them, we indeed have some recommendations which also resonate with the psychological literature on climate communication and science communication more generally. So this sounds very simple, but it often doesn't happen if you look at communications of climate in the media. The first one, or one general, is that climate communications should be phrased in words that the audiences can relate to and understand. So there are different ingredients to make this understandable and accessible. So the first one, very simple, is simplicity. So we often assume that the cognitive processing skills are much higher when it comes to risks such as climate change. But I mean, think about your daily life, like how many different things we deal with during a day. And then we read an article about climate change. Maybe that's like 5 minutes of our day, maybe 10 minutes if we do a little bit more of research. Or if we are very engaged, we do a little bit more research online about the content and the background. But else, we are flooded with so much information that if we as scientists want to communicate something, it needs to be super simple. So the clear and simple. The second one, building on that, is avoid acronyms and expert terminology. That is something that even the word climate projection might be something that someone who doesn't deal with this every day doesn't know exactly what it is. Like, why is it called climate projection and not prediction? And what is projected and where is it projected?
What are climate projections?
Climate projections are estimates of what the climate conditions could be in the future, depending on the impact of human activities on the climate system.
So that assumes a lot of background knowledge on a reference time period in the past about frequency of extreme weather, for example, like rain or rainfall, and then a time period in the future that something is projected into, and so on and so forth. So already this word requires a lot of background knowledge. So the question is, how can we translate this into something that a non-expert can relate to? The third point is related to events that individuals are familiar with or that they have experienced in the past, or I would say in more simple words, that are kind of tangible. So we often talk about probabilities of change, and already probabilities are quite complicated. You require quite some statistical knowledge, in particular when the probabilities are nested into each other, in order to understand what they actually mean. So my recommendation or advice would be translate these abstract probabilities into frequencies of something that we can make a meaning of. So to give you a quick example, we had massive floods in Germany twice in the last 2 decades, in northern Germany in particular.
Further north in Germany, they were braced for worse. Houses were flooded, boats became the means of transport, lives were disrupted, homes destroyed by water.
And these floods were communicated as 100-year floods. Mm-hmm. So what happened is that a massive flood occurred, cities got flooded, massive damage to infrastructure, to housing, and so on and so forth. People were dislocated for at least some time, and so on. Like all the consequences massive floods have, which we have seen enough in the media over the last couple of years. And this was communicated as 100-year flood. So a basic misunderstanding, and this has been tested by psychologists, of a 100-year flood is that people, okay, think 100 years. This flood has occurred. It won't occur for the next 100 years, which is a wrong translation of this probability 1 in 100, because it means over a long time period, an average, it occurs every 100 years. But it doesn't tell us it can occur tomorrow, it can happen tomorrow again, actually. So it doesn't tell us something about the single events. This is something that is related on, or based on statistics that relate to, yeah, longer time periods and so on. So 1% likelihood of a flood is also not like perfect, I would say. But to translate it into something like, okay, if we had 100 days like the day of tomorrow, this would occur in one day, actually. So this actually doesn't relate to any time when it occurs, but it can just occur. So people know it can be 2 days in a row, it can be 35 days apart, or it can be 89 days apart or something like that. So in other words, translate these abstract probabilities like 1% into something that we can actually relate to, and that also resonates with our perceptions of randomness. And then finally, I think that's something that we have learned in our studies is test the communications that are used. So as psychologists, we run similar empirical studies as biologists do in the lab, only that we do these studies with humans. So we have test groups and control groups, and we present them with different types of information and see how people process that information, how much they memorize, how much they trust into that information, and also sometimes how they communicate about that information to others. So this empirical testing reveals very interesting insights, and I'm always stunned by how difficult it is to translate this information into something that we can actually relate to and understand. So it's worth looking at it from an empirical perspective.
How do you think public actions, for example, the student strikes and the ongoing protest of Extinction Rebellion, lead or propel emotion and a political response?
So I think one thing that they are really successful in is that they make it very simple. So what is the message of Extinction Rebellion? I think they say something like 11 years until the disaster happens, or something like that. So that we have 11 years left, which is a very short time, even when it would not be climate but a different risk, like a health risk or so, to change a whole system and infrastructure. Yeah, so this is boiling it down to something super simple that we can all relate to. So it's a time period that we can relate to. I think that's something crucial in this message of Extinction Rebellion. It's much easier to understand than long-term periods of climate projections, which are used in climate research, actually, and which have been used also by decision makers to adapt infrastructures and so on and so forth. A second thing is that the students and Extinction Rebellion make it very visible. So immediately you have people on the street which talk about a risk that is non-local. And this is a strong social cue. So in a simplified way, from a psychological perspective, we often underestimate how social we are. Like, we are parts of a network. We talk always about individualism, but we are, in fact, so dependent on other people around us, and we identify with them so strongly. So from a psychological research point of view, there are a lot of studies, for example, from the health domain and also from environmental behavior, showing that these social cues about what behavior of others does and shows influences us quite a lot, even more if we identify with the values. And now I come to the third point regarding this. Mm-hmm. So simple messages, making it visible. And then also what I'm personally impressed about regarding Extinction Rebellion is the diversity of individuals who organize it. So you have deans from a university who quit their job, or people who were in like high management positions, and you have people from a broad range of social and economic backgrounds being part of this movement. And I think this makes identification with this movement maybe easier, and also the attention of the media, of the different types of media, increases, because there are people with different types of interests and levels of education and so on and so forth. So I don't want to go into the discussion if it's good or not good that this is less an environmental movement but a broader movement and maybe less leftish. There has been a big debate about this, but which I don't want to judge here. But from a psychological perspective, it may fuel the movement that there are people with different types of backgrounds, and that this allows a broader audience to identify, or broader public to identify with.
Yeah, you're right. But that is one of the criticisms about the movement. As inclusive as it may seem, it still is quite exclusive. And there are people kind of coming out saying they don't feel part of it. And I wonder what the different methods or means could be to broaden that engagement with people even more so.
Yeah, so I would say they take it out of the environmental corner. And this is something that Greta Thunberg has, and the whole movement that builds up behind her. So she's just the face of this. But her speeches show that very well, I think, that this is not a predominantly environmental problem. And I think this is like, this is makes it much easier to identify with climate or the climate risk, or perceive it as a risk that may affect not only environmentalists, or that might not only concern environmentalists, but that may concern many other people as well, because we face changes in extreme weather. To stick to an example in the UK, floods and heat waves will change here. What my colleagues at the Sustainability Research Institute here at the University of Leeds say, who are experts in the politics and in the economics of change, is that one of the major things that is important when it comes to climate change is to express your opinion, to vote differently, to take political action, to talk to your social environments. Talking about climate change, making it visible that you think about it, is quite important. So Extinction Rebellion is one way. If you don't agree with this, we have all the freedom to choose a different way.
Do you think the scientific community has a role to play in supporting the public to take political action?
So I would love to have a discussion with this about a historian, with a historian of science. Like, what has been the role of science for political action across time? From my very personal perspective, I would say yes. because we have amazing tools and an amazing education to provide the background knowledge for this. I don't want to say we, because I'm not a climate scientist, I'm a social scientist that studies communication, so I do this translation work mainly, but this can bring a completely different level of credibility to a movement to say, like, this is backed up, this is not backed up, and so on and so forth. And in my view, this is also one of the most impressive aspects of the student strikes, is that they very, very closely build on scientific knowledge. So just to draw on Greta Thunberg again, she collaborates very closely with a climate professor called Kevin Anderson, and she gets advice from people from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, and so she builds on scientific knowledge, and this leaves less room for political values and strong underlying values. And I think this, in my view, makes this movement so credible and so strong.
I know many of you don't want to listen to us. You say we are just children. We are only repeating the message of the United Climate Science.
And it builds also on something that characterizes our everyday decision making. So as human beings, and I hesitate a little bit to formulate it in such a general way, but many of our decisions are implicitly or explicitly guided by expert advice. So whoever is an expert in a specific social environment, it might be a scientist, it might be a doctor in health. This is like super strong and has been studied, that people are so related to what their doctor says instead. And don't question that. I mean, that also obviously makes sense in many cases, but don't question that, even if the evidence that they may find online or that is available, like solid scientific evidence, say something else. So follow the expert is a simple rule of thumb that helps us navigating through the complexities and uncertainties of our daily life. And I think as scientists, we can be these experts. And this leads me to the ultimate question, how do we become these experts? So we are there since, or climate scientists are there ringing the alarm bells since so many decades, and they just haven't been listened to. This is one of the main points of the students' strikes that they make. And they haven't been listened to. So I think we need to ask ourselves, how do we increase trust into what we say? Trust can become a very strong predictor about how credible information is perceived to be and how much people follow it and integrate into their decisions. And I think the whole history of climate science and its relation to politics shows that trust was a determining factor. So the so-called climate denialists did a brilliant job in causing mistrust into science. So in everything we communicate, I think one of the underlying aspects we need to have in mind is always, like, how does that increase trust, and how can we increase the credibility of our messages while sticking to the science, of course. So I think together with the scientists they collaborate, that the young students who drive the climate strikes have done a brilliant job in firstly translating climate knowledge into accessible messages based on scientific evidence, and also have expressed trust into science. This has, I think, fueled the movement as well, that you can see them all the time talking to scientists and at the same time having very clear messages. So this, in my view, is very, very impressive, and I can't remember that this has happened before.
How do you think we should be communicating climate science to increase trust and action? For example, using positive and empowering tactics, or using more negative, scare tactics?
Yeah, there is a lot of debate around this in the field of environmental psychology about how frightening should a message be. And there is one in the theories from the field of environmental psychology, there is one aspect called locus of control, which is a predictor for behavior, or you might call it agency or empowerment. There are very many words for describing this locus of control thing, but it influences how likely somebody is to do something. So, for example, why should I stop eating meat if I see that everybody around me like continues eating meat? It's like has no impact at all. So I think from an agency perspective, it's important to provide people with simple tools about what they can do and what makes actually an impact. And they deserve, because we live in a democracy and we need to make political decisions, like in a democratic state, they deserve that type of information as well, which is very simple, but at the same time backed up by scientific evidence about what they can do, so what is effective actually. So very simple information about how consumption decisions relate to carbon footprints. That doesn't mean that I immediately need to cut out all my flights or completely need to stop eating meat, but it may change my perception of it. I may change on an individual level. I may talk about this more. I may change my political decisions I make, like, for example, for whom I vote and what kind of actions I support and so on and so forth. So I think very simple information or tools about what we can do changes what we do.
About that idea of making it more visible, a friend was just telling me that he was at a pub and next to everything on the menu, similar to when they used to do like caloric values on every item on the menu, they now had carbon emissions associated with each item on the menu, and kind of that interesting spin on where we can include information and how it can be accessible and how it can be kind of integrated into our everyday decisions.
Yeah, and I find this a very nice way of communicating these types of information, because presenting that information like on the menu that you just described allows me to make a better informed decision. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate question for me as a psychologist is also, how can I inform decisions better? What do I know about my target audiences or target audiences of climate communications that allows me to design the information in a way that they are better informed and can still make independent decisions? Mm-hmm. And the pub could also say, like, we cut everything from our menu, mm-hmm. or we don't want you to eat this, or something like that. Like, right. There are different ways of influencing decisions, but I think this is a very important aspect of change. I don't think this is the main predictor of change, but it's a very important aspect of change to keep this information transparent. I've recently read a study from a British scientist as well, who shows that what we do has actually, in particular when it comes to environmental behaviors, has knock-on effects on our social environment. So I may be the one who says I don't fly and I don't impose it on others. I just don't fly, and that affects my social life in particular, and maybe also my work life, if you're a scientist in particular. So this study that he ran, the survey that this person ran, he showed that it makes also people in your social environments less likely to fly. So I think we have to keep that in mind as well. So first of all, agency is a strong predictor of behavior. So we should frame behavior in a way that, or we perceive it as having an influence. And there are many behaviors which have an influence on climate. And secondly, we don't do things for ourselves, but we also do them embedded into our social environments, to come back to what I said in the beginning, that we are social beings and individualism is a nice thing, but still every day with everything that we do, we're dependent on others and we also influence others. So yeah, it's not only us who make this decision, but our environments do for us, or we do for our environments as well.
Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank
Astrid.
You, Astrid. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's all for today's show. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed.
On the next episode, we will talk with Amanda Maycock and Martin Chipperfield from the University of Leeds about the ocean hole. Don't miss it!
The music of this episode was written and played by Kevin Facilio and Andrew Wilson from the Leeds College of Music, and Marcos Arribas and Paloma Trascasa from the University of Leeds.
Stay tuned for upcoming episodes and follow us on Twitter using @theclimatepress.
please visit our website, theclimatepress.com.
See you soon! And remember, make love, not CO2.